Case number 19-3094, United States of America versus Russell Davis. Arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Belli, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Dennis Belli. I represent Russell Davis, who appeals from his conviction and life sentence for distribution of fentanyl resulting in death. This case is a good example of why prosecutors should talk to their witnesses before the indictment stage. And I say that because the indictment in this case alleges that Russell Davis distributed a fatal dosage of fentanyl to the victim. Clearly alleges a direct transaction between the two. However, by the time of trial, apparently the prosecutors realized that that was not the case. And they altered their theory of prosecution. And I describe this theory of prosecution as being analogous to strict liability in tort, the products liability principles that apply in civil actions. According to the government, at least in the trial, it was sufficient that Mr. Davis allegedly sold fentanyl to someone, and that was passed on to somebody else who had died. And we would submit that there's no legal authority for that.
Why isn't the plain text the legal authority for it? Because the way I read the text, all it says is that a death must result from the controlled substance that's identified in 841A. And so where do you get the limitation? Your limiting principle seems to be that in order to be liable under the death results enhancement, you have to have delivered the drug personally to the individual who died. But I'm having a hard time seeing where that comes from the language of the sentencing enhancement. And so I'm wondering if you could articulate your theory for why B1C in the death results language has this limiting principle on which you're relying.
Because we're not proceeding on a blank slate. If this was a case of first impression, that would be an argument that would need to be discussed. But
so are you saying that our precedent is wrong, or do you actually have do you have a theory of why your interpretation of Swiney, or I don't know how to pronounce the case name, but how your interpretation of that case is consistent with the plain language of the statute?
Because after Swiney was decided and after the parties briefed this case, this court came out with a decision, United States versus Ham, that discussed Swiney in great detail in very similar circumstances to this case. In the Ham case, Mr. Ham was an intermediate distributor of carfentanil. And the facts showed that he distributed a portion of his carfentanil to a young lady who was the individual who then redistributed the carfentanil to one person who died and three jail inmates who suffered, who overdosed on it. So the facts in that case clearly showed that there was not a direct transaction between defendant Ham and the decedent. And what the court said in Ham, relying on Swiney, basically Swiney was decided before the Supreme Court ruled that juries, not judges, must decide certain sentencing factors. So what Ham did was clarify how Swiney applies in the jury trial context, post-Apprendi, post-Alene. And what the court said is that the approach has to be twofold. Number one, is the defendant guilty of the distribution that was made directly to the decedent? So if the defendant did not personally distribute to the decedent, then the government must rely on Pinkerton co-conspirator liability. The government must show, number one, that the person who did the distribution to the decedent was a co-conspirator, and number two, that distribution was reasonably foreseeable to the defendant and within the course of the conspiracy.
But correct me if I'm wrong, are both of those cases, both Swiney and Ham, involved conspiracy theories, as I understand the cases, by which I mean either a conspiracy was the basis, was the charge itself, 846, or conspiracy was the basis for finding a substantive violation. But we don't have that here. This is a direct claim of he personally violated 841A1 by himself distributing drugs. So why isn't that a basis to distinguish those cases and just to follow the plain text of the sentencing enhancement?
Well, because in Ham, if that was the case, then there would have been no need to discuss a co-conspirator liability. The death results enhancement was attached to a substantive count. And if the government could simply proceed on that basis that all you need is one distribution of drug that at some point down the line causes the death of another person, then the whole conversation, the whole discussion about Swiney would be moot. And
so correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't one of the theories for substantive liability a conspiracy theory in Ham?
Yes.
But that's not the case here, right? There's only the one direct liability. There wasn't a liability, a Pinkerton type liability that you conspired with them. And so you yourself violated the substantive provision.
And that's why the defendant should win, because the government cannot establish his liability for the distribution that Mr. Karopoulos made to the decedent without relying on a vicarious theory of liability, because Mr. Davis never dealt with the decedent. That's undisputed. So,
Mr. Belli, I mean, it seems that the facts here fit less perhaps a conspiracy theory of liability than something more like a constructive delivery by Mr. Davis to the decedent, because the decedent and Karopoulos, or I'm probably misstating his name, they pooled their money, and the defendant, I think, was aware of the fact that the buyer in front of him was buying for the two people. And so so the defendant either, you know, in a constructive sense or in some other legal sense, was delivering the drugs. Everyone understood he was delivering the drugs to both of them, not one person, which is a different theory than conspirator liability, but it would seem to be one that is a common sense assessment of these facts. Well, how would you answer that?
That the facts don't support that. There are no facts supporting the proposition.
If they did, Mr. Belli, I mean, if they did, would that be a valid basis for the criminal judgment here?
No, I don't think so. And a few months ago, I had prevailed in an appeal in state court where the prosecution was making that argument, and a state court of appeals said, no, you have to show either the direct sale or some accepted theory. And plus, the jury here was not instructed on a constructive sale to another individual. And as we cited the case in Dunn versus United States, a court of appeals cannot affirm a conviction on a theory that is not presented to the jury, even though the court of appeals feels that if a properly instructed jury would find the defendant guilty on the uninstructed theory. So I don't think, my understanding of the record is that Mr. Davis only dealt with Mr. Karopoulos. Now, Castro White, the decedent, understood that Kraplis was buying drugs from Mr. Davis and other sources, but there's no evidence that Davis understood that.
Mr. Bell, this is Judge Gilman.
Yes.
How do you distinguish United States v. Jeffries, a decision of this court on May the 8th? And I'm quoting one sentence. It says, because death or injury from the use of the substance is inherently foreseeable, there is no need to require the government to prove that they were reasonably foreseeable to the defendant.
Okay. Well, Jeffries was a one-on-one transaction. The defendant sold directly to the buyer. And Jeffries deals with foreseeability of death. And what the court said is that when one sells drugs to another person that has the potential of causing death, then there's no need to instruct the jury about foreseeability. But Jeffries' foreseeability is a whole different matter from Pinkerton foreseeability. And Pinkerton is a Supreme Court case. Pinkerton talks about whether one co-conspirator is responsible for a crime committed by a fellow co-conspirator. So they're totally different types of foreseeability. And that's where things get a little confusing. And Jeffries in the footnote stated that it was dealing with a different issue than Ham, which was decided like a month or month and a half before Jeffries. And I'll just wrap up with one other argument with regard to the sufficiency of the evidence. And that's basically what we've all been discussing here. Our argument that the evidence is insufficient rests on three different alternatives. Number one, the jury was never instructed on a theory upon which they could find Mr. Davis guilty. Number two, the evidence shows that, according to Mr. Kraplis, he was a user. There's no way that a jury could find that he's a co-conspirator. And finally, Kraplis testified that he purchased heroin, and we disagree that he purchased it from Davis, and that's a whole other issue there, because there was another drug dealer that was only a few blocks away from Mr. Davis, and they easily could have gone there except rather than Mr. Davis. But Kraplis says he bought heroin from Mr. Davis. And we know that in Mr. Castro White's bloodstream, there was fentanyl, not heroin. And we also know that Mr. Kraplis and Mr. Castro White had a portion of the drugs that Mr. Kraplis had purchased, but then Mr. Kraplis passed out. Mr. Castro White stole $40 from his wallet. And then several hours later, he's found dead. And the only thing in his bloodstream is fentanyl. And under this court's previous decision, and I think it was Atkins, the court found that that was legally insufficient evidence to show that the drugs that the defendant allegedly sold were the same drugs that killed the victim. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Belli. You'll have your rebuttal. Hear from Mr. Call.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Matt Call for the government. The evidence proved that Jacob Castro White died from a fentanyl overdose and that the defendant, Russell Red Davis, sold those drugs to Castro White and Harry Karapalis. Now, the defense is trying on appeal to impose an additional requirement that Section 841 and this court's precedents don't require. He's trying to ask this court to impose some sort of privity of contract type of a relationship between the seller and the victim. As Judge Murphy seemed to point out in his questioning, that's not supported by the text of 841. The text of 841 simply says if you've distributed drugs under A1 or delivered drugs, you're guilty of the offense. And the penalty provision B1C says that if death or serious bodily injury results from the use of such substance, then the enhanced penalty applies in this case.
And what would you say, Mr. Call, to Mr. Belli's argument that Ham and Swinney have overlaid the statutory text with this sort of either a hand-to-hand transaction type requirement or that you have to show some sort of conspiratorial liability?
I read those exactly the opposite way, Your Honor. In fact, in Ham, the problem was that the distribution was proven through a Pinkerton theory of liability, and the jury instructions in Ham imposed the enhanced penalty only as a result of a Pinkerton theory as well. And that was what created the error and required reversal in Ham. In the jury instructions here, there was no Pinkerton theory. The government was only proceeding under a substantive theory of distribution and a substantive proof that death resulted from it. And there was never any Pinkerton instruction. It's kind of ironic. In their initial brief, they said such an instruction should have been required. And as Ham has come out, as Ham has come out and as Jeffries has come out, this court has made clear that when the government proceeds that way, it can't use Pinkerton liability to get the death results enhancement. Ultimately here—
So where does, under the plain text, does your argument have any type of limiting principle? I can imagine, what if a defendant sells to a person who then gets robbed of the drugs, and the robber of that drugs then sells to some other person who sells to some other person? Could you charge the first defendant if there's a death at the end of that long chain? Could you charge the first defendant who actually distributed the drugs with the death results enhancement?
In your hypo, Your Honor, I'm not sure that the initial defendant is guilty of an offense. If he's robbed of the drugs, he hasn't—
No. The defendant distributes the drugs to a consumer, and the consumer is then robbed of the drugs, and then the robber resells them to somebody else, and that somebody else dies. So the defendant did distribute the drugs that ultimately led to somebody else's death long down the causal chain. I assume that is the government's position, that as long as you can show a distribution violation and a death somewhere, that it's sufficient for the enhancement.
That is what we believe, Your Honor. And we think that's supported by Ham, which said that if you can prove that the defendant was in the chain of distribution, that is sufficient to hold him guilty for the enhancement, assuming, of course, that we can prove the 841A1 violation. And that makes sense, really. Taking it to a more realistic scenario, a high-level supplier shouldn't be able to insulate himself or herself from this enhanced penalty merely by putting several intermediaries in between them. And the statutory text doesn't seem to provide any kind of privity of contract type requirement, which is what Mr. Belli is seeming to require. And let's remember, we're not only— the standard of review here is plain error. The jury instructions here, Mr. Davis agreed to below. And in fact, I would point out to this court, they are verbatim the same instructions that this court a month ago found in the Jeffries case were proper. So we don't think that their challenge to the jury instructions or the causation instructions has anywhere to go. The court—
Can I ask you, switching gears a little bit, if that's okay.
Yes.
Can I ask, just on harmless error, I'm having on the probable cause and the affidavit issue, I'm trying to figure out what evidence under the harmless error analysis actually would have been suppressed if under your theory that we should just immediately go to the harmless error analysis. And I'll ask both sides this, I'll ask this of rebuttal too. As I understand, most of the evidence came from other sources, and I was hoping you could clarify that. Either the toll records from the telephone companies or text message from Castro White himself from the 3 days. So as I understood, the evidence we're talking about here are the search of the drugs that were found at the home, and then maybe a few of the text messages, one of which was actually quite helpful to the defendant, the was asleep text message. What other evidence would have been excluded and that should be considered under harmless error analysis? If you wouldn't mind talking about that a bit.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the court has, or Your Honor, you've accurately stated what it would be. The text messages from the defendant's own phone which include the what the defense says is exculpatory text message was sleep, was something obtained during the search. The evidence that the government relied upon, the most incriminating evidence, was all obtained prior to and obviously independent of the search of the defendant's residence. Prior to searching the defendant's residence, the government had obtained text messages from Verizon Wireless from the victim, Mr. Castro White's telephone. They had obtained the call detail records, the cell phone location information, had located and talked to both Mr. Stock and Mr. Carapalis. And it was all of that information that led us to the search of the defendant's home. In the defendant's home, there was no fentanyl found. There was marijuana and there was cocaine, which he pled guilty to. And then we found his cell phone. Now, the cell phone certainly was a helpful piece of evidence for us, but it was cumulative. We had already learned from both Stock and from Carapalis the defendant's phone number, which ended in, I believe, 8810. And we would have been able to prove that because Mr. Carapalis was cooperating with law enforcement, made a controlled and recorded phone call to Mr. Davis on that telephone. He identified him by voice. Detective Sievert identified him by voice. So finding the defendant's telephone was an important piece of evidence, but it was cumulative.
Well, let me in closing argument, the government said that cell phone was a treasure trove of information. And that you argue that. So how can you say that that wasn't a reasonable possibility that the evidence complained of might have contributed to the conviction, which is the standard under United States versus DeSantis, our case?
It is, Your Honor. It was a treasure trove of information showing that Mr. Davis was a drug dealer, a point that he never contested and continues not to contest. His defense at trial was not that I'm not a drug dealer, I didn't distribute drugs. His defense at trial was I didn't sell these particular drugs that night. And his most important piece of evidence for that was this was sleep text message, which came from that phone. And we wouldn't have obtained that phone but for the search warrant. If I could just interrupt for a moment, Deputy Milton, I believe Judge Murphy is missing.
Judge Kethledge, I believe we lost Judge Murphy.
All right. Let's pause the time for the argument, please.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And we'll try to bring Judge Murphy back. Mr. Call, you may proceed. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, Mr. Call, does the government concede that the affidavit for the search warrant was insufficient?
The affidavit itself on the four corners? Yes, I do, Your Honor. We do.
Okay.
However,
so your defense, your answer then is, well, why in that tough luck? Well, because you're saying it's harmless. Is that basically your response?
That's one of the two responses. The other response, Your Honor, is that the magistrate judge recognized that it was deficient and took additional oral information at the time that he, before issuing the warrant, and we proffered that information in our suppression response. It was always our understanding that Judge Boyko would hold a suppression hearing at which we could present that evidence. And then shortly after we filed our response, he went ahead and ruled based on the information that we proffered in our motion. The Shields case from this court says that additional information, if provided under oath, can be used as the basis to support a search warrant. And that's what happened here. Both Detective Sievert and Magistrate Judge Cook, if called, we believe would have testified about additional information that Sievert provided to the magistrate judge before he issued the warrant.
Well, tell me some of that information. Issue a limited remand then for that purpose? There's a case we've got, United States v. Beals from 2012, that provides that procedure.
Yes, Your Honor. If the court finds that there's a reasonable possibility, if you don't go with our harmless error argument, we'd ask the court to issue a limited remand for that evidentiary hearing. The trial testimony shows that Detective Sievert had that additional information. He testified about it at 824 to 832. Harry Carapolis testified about that at 1495 to 1496. There was a plethora of additional information. Carapalis specifically identified Mr. Davis. He picked out his house on a Google satellite map or a Google Earth image. Then Detective Sievert verified that it was Davis's house by pulling police records regarding Mr. Davis and by verifying his car was at that. So the nexus, which doesn't appear in the four corners of the affidavit, was established under oath before the magistrate judge, before the warrant was issued.
And it was what do you do about Masters or Masters' case, which suggests that the magistrate didn't even have the authority to issue this warrant?
The Master case is puzzling. It's an unreported case from an intermediate Ohio court. And
no, I'm talking about, I'm talking about our Sixth Circuit case that suggests the Fourth Amendment is violated if an actor, a state actor who doesn't have authority to issue warrants actually issues the warrant.
Well, Ohio Revised Code 2933.23 says that judges or magistrates in Ohio may issue warrants. And this was a Lorain County municipal court magistrate. So under Ohio law, the magistrate did have the power. In that case, the judge was issuing a warrant completely outside of his jurisdiction in Masters. That was a separate independent Fourth Amendment violation. Here, their claim that the warrant was void from the beginning because it was not signed by a proper person is based on an unreported Ohio case that still upheld the or still did not order suppression because of good faith.
Well, I did. I did a fair amount of research. I recognize that magistrate can mean different things in different contexts. And here, I think there's a fair amount of Ohio state case law suggesting that this particular type of magistrate couldn't issue these warrants. I think there's several cases from the courts of appeals, at least that I saw, that suggested that it had to be a court of common pleas judge and not a magistrate judge who's connected to the court of common pleas.
I did not see that in Mr. Belli's brief. This was an issue that was never raised below. It was raised for the first time on appeal. And Ohio Revised Code 2933.23 says a judge or magistrate may issue warrants if it is based on probable cause. So we believe that is sufficient here. Moving on to, if there are no more questions on the search issue, I'll briefly state that the argument that there was some sort of a constructive amendment or variance from the indictment simply is not supported here. Again, it's a plain error claim because it wasn't raised below. There was no amendment or constructive amendment. The defendant was charged with a A1 distribution of fentanyl, and he was convicted of that. And the Citrone case that Mr. Belli cites for Mr. Davis doesn't require a different result. There, the Supreme Court found a constructive amendment because the defendant was charged with an extortion scheme involving sand, I believe, being imported from Pennsylvania, and the government proved an extortion scheme about steel being exported to, I think it was Michigan and Kentucky. I think the fair analogy would have been if the government charged Mr. Davis with distributing fentanyl, but instead proved he had been distributing cocaine or methamphetamine, that would be a more fair analogy. But there was no constructive amendment. At most here, there was a variance, but we don't even think there was here, and there certainly was no prejudice that resulted from it. The indictment states that the defendant distributed fentanyl, and the government proved that he distributed fentanyl. Mr. Belli harps on two words, the words two individual one, which is only in the penalty provision. This court stated in Ham that for the enhanced penalty provision to apply, we're required to prove that he was in the chain of distribution. Mr. Belli's trying to read an extra word directly, that he sold it directly to individual one. That's not in the indictment. And there was no prejudice here because the government made clear all along and the defendant very well knew that the government always believed that Harry Karapalis was the facilitator of this drug transaction. And we believe there was ample evidence from Mr. Karapalis and the phone records to show that Mr. Davis sold the drugs and those drugs caused Castro White's death. Thank you.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Call. We will hear rebuttal from Mr. Belli.
All right. The first thing, it would be a neat trick if the government could avoid its burden of proof by simply not asking the court to instruct the jury on what the proper burden is. The government made a similar argument in Ham, where they were alleging that sentencing enhancement provisions were attached to substantive distribution counts, and therefore they should not be held liable or have to prove principles of conspiracy liability. At page 747 of the opinion, the court stated, no one is alleging that Ham and Shields actually sold carfentanil to LKW, and he was the decedent, and the county jail inmates who had overdosed. They are only liable for the distribution to LKW and the inmates as Tracy Myers co-conspirators. And Tracy Myers was the one that actually sold the drugs or gave the drugs to those people.
Can I cut you off? Because I'm just curious about the harmless error question on the affidavit. In closing argument in this case, counsel for your client suggested that your client is the luckiest man alive. There's incredible evidence that exonerates him in this case. And the credible evidence comes in two words, was sleep. That strikes me as one of the principal things that would be excluded under your request for exclusion. I assume that diligent counsel would want to somehow get that text message in. So I'm curious what if you could talk just briefly about the harmlessness question and what you think should have been excluded if this affidavit was invalid.
Well, it would have been the phone and drugs that were seized from Mr. Davis's residence. The phone, as Judge Gilman pointed out, was considered a treasure trove of information.
But what specifically? I mean, what was on the phone that was, you know, that constituted harmful error? Because the drugs that were found were no big deal. So what information, notwithstanding the prosecution's characterization, what specifically was harmful?
The government alleged that the contents of the phone showed that Mr. Davis was a drug dealer. Now, defense counsel conceded that, but the defense counsel had to go with what they had at the time. They knew that evidence was coming in because the judge overruled the motion to suppress. They could have adopted a completely different approach. If nothing from the apartment was admitted, then the government would have been stuck with a guy that just lied consistently in his dealings with the police, Mr. Karapoulos, and attempt to shift his guilt to Mr. Davis. It would have been a far different case. But
you would agree, though, wouldn't you, if we excluded it, wouldn't it exclude the evidence that counsel suggested made your client the luckiest person in the world? I mean, we have to look at it, and I fail to see a world where diligent counsel would not do everything in counsel's power to get that text message in, because that seemed quite powerful to me, that it was contemporaneous evidence suggesting that he was asleep responding to a proposed drug deal.
I think the defense counsel would have to decide whether it would be better to forego that with the knowledge that all this other evidence was being admitted and just focus on the lack of credibility of the government's star witness. So I think that's why the burden of proving harmlessness is so important. Unlike plain error, this error was preserved, and therefore it's the government that has to show there is no reasonable possibility that the illegally obtained evidence contributed to the verdict. So I don't think the government has met that burden.
I
just have one final word?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Judge. I would ask the court, with regard to the sufficiency issue, I've concentrated on this conspiracy angle, but I also would ask the court to compare this case to United States versus Ewing, where this court reversed a conviction because the evidence failed to show that chain between the defendant's alleged distribution of drugs and the drugs that were actually found in the victim's bloodstream.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Belli. That concludes the argument for this case. And Mr. Belli, I note that you were appointed under the Criminal Justice Act, as I think you have been numerous times in my cases, and I think probably all of our cases here. I want to thank you for your very thorough and thoughtful representation. You have done, as in my experience, you've always done an admirable job of representing your client, and we sincerely appreciate it.
Thank you, Judge.
Case will be submitted. The clerk may call the next case.